Happy Friday, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Success Book. For those of you who don't know, my name is Jay Washington. Every Friday, I interview another young, successful, relatable entrepreneur. They share their stories with me, in turn share their stories with you, the audience, and we inspire you all to escape the 9-to-5, one episode at a time. So let's just get right into it. Andrew Aruda, founder and CEO of Automate Medical. He is also a featured TEDx speaker and the co-founder of Ross Intelligence. Automate is on a mission to liberate closed silos of health data. We all know how difficult it is to get your medical records when you go to the doctor or to the hospital. Automate has been zeroed in on this issue to make it fully AI and accessible to every single medical institution in the world. Amazing stuff. You'll hear all about how Andrew started it and how he became an entrepreneur in general after growing up as a first-generation immigrant in Toronto. Without further ado, please enjoy Andrew Aruda.
I think the first thing that kind of piqued my interest about you is you grew up in Toronto, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Toronto.
Were you born in Toronto or is that born, where you moved?
Born in Toronto, first generation immigrant it's an area called the Azores. It's the islands of Portugal, kind of in the middle of, yeah.
So what was that like growing up in Toronto as a first generation immigrant?
It was a really amazing experience. And I think it was really helpful for me to see kind of the world through different people's lenses. The way that I grew up, I realized that immigrants were really entrepreneurial. So it's almost like it was already in the blood to be an entrepreneur, just because the very act of immigrating and then starting up your life was such a huge challenge. So it also really, I think, helped me, because the road of being a founder is so tough that it offered a lot of perspective.
Right. So grew up with mom and dad, both in Toronto. You guys all moved together. Is that how it worked?
Well, yeah. So grew up in Toronto. My grandparents immigrated and then brought my parents over when they were young. And my parents were actually next door neighbors, which is kind of fun. A little kind of a fun Romeo and Juliet style in some ways too, because they were both from the same island in the Azores, grew up next to each other and ended up having my sister and I.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I feel like you mentioned already that there's already kind of an entrepreneurial spirit within immigrants. It's kind of innate. So is that for you kind of what shaped your early perspectives on what work should be like and what defines success as you got older?
Yeah, I think that definitely was a huge motivation / accelerant of the entrepreneurial bug. But I also think for me, the other big one was I thought being an entrepreneur was really exciting because you get to kind of set out and create and chase a vision that you get to almost create all on your own. So there was just this magical aspect of being an entrepreneur that I always was really excited about. Like ever since I was a kid, you know, I wanted to start a company. I wanted to, you know, create a new thing. And I think that, combined with this environment where people basically risked everything and went to a new country and didn't even speak the language, it all kind of had compounding effects.
Right. So you said that you kind of grew up with it in your head from the beginning, but you obviously started in the corporate world. Did you always anticipate kind of doing it there and starting and then eventually starting a company? Or was that something that you kind of got a little more quote unquote realistic about when you got older and then kind of looked at it like, okay, maybe I'll start here. And then once I built something up, I'll end up starting something possibly down the line.
No, I think actually, and this might be something that like listeners might actually also resonate with them. I think I found my way to the corporate world. So for background, I ended up going to law school, becoming a lawyer first, and then working at a small law firm. I think I did that a lot in many ways with pressure from my parents, my grandparents and family, because there's an element where, you know, while being an immigrant is very entrepreneurial, there also is an aspect of, you know, we sacrifice so much to come to this country.
Yeah.
Now, like integrate and kind of get a great job and live, you know, the American or Canadian dream.
Right.
And so I think for me, it was kind of like first generation immigrants, it's tough for them to necessarily break away from that because it's almost like it's too risky because there's really nothing to fall back on. And entrepreneurs, you know, and I, it's not a knock on anyone who's an entrepreneur who comes from, you know, a family that might be, you know, middle or upper, or upper, you know, kind of socioeconomic classes. It's just, it ended up being like, wow, like you, it's like, we don't get to be entrepreneurs like that. Like, we don't get to just go off and pursue our, there's even an aspect of like, we don't even get to fully pursue our dreams. It's like the first generation puts in the work, lays the foundation. And you know what, Andrew, if you're lucky, your kid could be able to be an entrepreneur or do these things. Like, that's not for us. That's for the third, you know, not the first, but the second or the third generation.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's weird. It's interesting you brought that up, because I was actually going to ask that, like, what kind of pressures there were around the family and how, if it negatively impacted kind of your perspective of it, you know, growing up and wanting to start a business, because that's a big aspect of it. No, it's like, you can't ignore the noise coming from your immediate family. They're the reason you're where you are.
Yeah. I mean, the thing also was, is like, they had so much love for me, and I saw how much sacrifice they put in. Right. Yeah. So it's like, my grandma and grandpa moved on both sides from the same island, like I mentioned. And it's like, I can't imagine that, like, I would talk to them about it. And like, they got into a plane that took off from, like, you know, like a cornfield, man, like from an island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Right.
And they get to a country and they're very like, follow the rules. You know, we're lucky to be here, get a job. And for them, they told me I could, you know, I always joke, you could be anything you want as long as there's a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. And so I did that. And in some ways, to be honest, Jay, I think a lot of that was for me to almost give back to that dream. And then for me to show my respect to their sacrifices. And also to let, you know, especially my parents, they knew that when I started to go out and I told them I wanted to really pursue my entrepreneurial side, they almost rest a little bit easy, because they were like, well, he has a law degree, he could go back and be a lawyer. Like, that's fine. He's okay. I did tell them though, Jay, I told them, like, even before I finished, I wanted to do it. And I was willing to do that. So the timing worked out, but I think that's kind of how I view that. And I'm very lucky that I did that, because it offered me, my first startup was in the legal world. It offered me really interesting perspective on that, and gave me insider knowledge. But I think a lot of that, and the corporate side and what I did, was a lot of, you know, making sure I kind of paid respect to the sacrifice of the people before me. And, you know, there's something about me, sometimes I'm like, maybe I shouldn't have had to do that. You know, it would have been, maybe I should have just jumped in and become an entrepreneur early. I think it would have actually helped me get some scrapes and bruises. One of my favorite songs is like Frank Sinatra, I Did It My Way. And he said, you know, regrets are too few to mention. And I think like, that's life, you know?
Yeah. And did you feel like you were settling almost when you went into the corporate world? It kind of just like appeasing them almost?
Yeah, absolutely. I also felt like it wasn't necessarily for me. Like I would enjoy it, but I was always like, the entrepreneurial side of me was always asking, why do we do things this way? How can it be improved? How could I be a person who makes a dent on the, in the universe? Like, as cliche as that sounds, like I was someone who just really wanted to make a difference. And that's like, it's not all like, you want to make a difference for many reasons. Some of it is ego as well. Like, I'm not going to say it's all altruistic, but there's an element where I said, like, I always remember as a kid, I always thought to myself, well, who affects change? It's a human, and we're all human. Therefore, like, anyone can affect change if you believe and you can do it. And so there was just an element in me where I just kind of was like, everyone that I've ever looked up to is flesh, blood, and bones, just like I am. And they've sacrificed, and I look up to that, but it's not like they're a robot or anything. So it's possible. And so I just dreamt big that way.
But I also have to imagine that the critical thinking aspect for you probably helped when you did go into becoming a lawyer. And from what I understand, you were a litigator, which is, you know, there's kind of a stigma around litigators, you know, they're very direct and to the point, and, you know, they have a certain gravitas. But I feel like that probably helped you initially, did it?
Yeah, it certainly, I mean, like, one of the cool things, it hurts and it helped and it hurt. Like, one of the things about, you know, being a litigator is you have to be quick on your feet, and you also have to see things through different dimensions. I think for me, especially early days of a startup, you're kind of thinking through the problems, you're trying to be creative. The challenge, though, about law is, I think sometimes you get into you start to defend your idea or your way of doing something. And the litigation side of my brain, it was hard for me to turn that off and try to be a collaborative manager and, right. and kind of an entrepreneur. It's, in other words, it was helpful to get from starting from the early stages to idea stage. But as soon as you start adding on more people to the team, I think at that point, it actually was something that needed to be flipped over and
switched. Right. So you started Ross Intelligence after having been in the legal space. Did that background really, you know, help you kind of get the ideas and the processes in place and kind of give you the inspiration to really even get into that industry?
Yeah. So I had, it's actually kind of interesting. I ended up working at a small law firm in my hometown in Toronto in my first year of college. So I started working there in the summer and then I started taking night courses at college so I could work at the office during the day. Yeah. And I actually, by the time I finished law school, I'd been at that law firm for like 7 years. And I did everything from work as a receptionist. Like I answered phones, I photocopied, I got people coffee. And then I worked my way up to like legal assistant. So then I was, you know, emailing, scheduling, and then I became a student at law in Canada so I could go do small claims court. Then eventually I was a full-blown lawyer. So I got to see all the aspects of the business. Mm-hmm. And I think being at a smaller law firm was really helpful because small law firms, I think there still is a very entrepreneurial vibe and lens.
Yeah.
And that allowed me to understand the problems of the industry. So one of the things they always tell you, regardless of whatever business you're going into, you always want to like know how they do things and you want to get subject matter experts and interview users.
Yeah.
But the neat thing for me was I had lived the ins and outs of a law firm and the reality of that at almost every position at the firm for 7 years. Yeah. So I definitely think that helped me because then, you know, my first company was really around legal research and adding efficiencies and what that meant for clients, but also what that meant for business reasons, you know, increasing revenue, increasing your win rate. I wasn't just one dimensional in that way. So it definitely helped.
Okay. Basically, Ross was, you know, kind of a legal research platform that integrated AI into the research aspect for lawyers, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. Instead of control F to find things from millions of things, millions of cases, you would just ask your question like you were having a conversation with another human.
Right.
He would bring you back what you needed.
So, okay. So you said that your parents kind of, they were a little bit okay. Your family was a little bit okay with you doing this because you had already gotten your degree and you had become a lawyer already. You could always kind of go back. But how did they receive you actually, you know, doing it, like leaving the corporate world, starting your own thing, even after their
blessing? It was a mixed reaction. Like okay. I always like to joke, like when I told my parents I was going to make the leap from, because at first I was I would be working on the project with my co-founders. And then kind of still maintaining my job. And eventually I was like, it's just not going to scale this way. And at that time we got into Y Combinator, the accelerator out in Silicon Valley. So we were going to move out there from Toronto. So I told my family, I was like, hey, I'm doing this. I'm leaving. I'm going to sell my larger possessions. And I ended up like putting all my stuff in two hockey bags, which is a very Canadian kind of thing. And I was like, I'm doing this. And I think they had known that I had been wanting to do this. But at that point, they've been always supportive. So I wouldn't say they weren't supportive, but it wasn't like hip hip hooray. It was like, hey, like, are you sure? Like, you know, you should really consider not doing this. And like, you know, it's a big risk and it is a risk. You know, you always hear the stories from the people who the risks work out.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the end of the day, you know, I think when it comes to doing stuff like this, I'm not a gambler. I'm not someone who likes to take risks. And I think doing and pursuing something when you have the conviction most people's biggest regrets are not for things they did. It's for things they didn't do.
That resonates, I'm sure, with a lot of people even now, just like in jobs that they might, you know, feel like they're kind of stuck in. For you, I mean, you moved all the way across the country, like from Canada for the most part into a different country, regardless of your family. Obviously they were on the fence about it, but for you, like, was that difficult at all in your head, or was it you already had it in your head for so long that it was just kind of
easy? It was definitely difficult. And you know, at the time I was making a pretty good salary, but I didn't have any savings because I had a bunch of student debt. And the idea for my first startup really was born out of my co-founder's mind, who was a computer scientist. And he had called me, and because he knew how much experience I had in law, and he was like, you know, what do you think about this? And he was gung ho because he was more like, he knew about the tech world. I didn't know anything about technology.
Yeah.
And I knew I was always passionate about the internet and computers, but I never knew anything about like what Y Combinator was and, you know, all this stuff.
Of course.
So, I mean, I was now injected, you know, across the continent into a whole world. And at that time we were paying ourselves $1,000 a month and we had just mattresses down in a house. And there was, four or five people living in like a two bedroom, three bedroom maximum spot.
Very on brand.
Yeah. On the ground working 24/7. And it was a lot of fun, Jay, but at the same time, there was an element of like, we had to make it work. I think at that point, I believed so much in the mission and what we were doing and that it would work out that I was willing to go like all or nothing on it. And that's kind of the way I would say. So it's like, I went all or nothing on it. And my thinking was, I'm either going to be right, or if I'm wrong, I'm going to learn a lot. And at least I'll always know for the rest of my life that I did it. And I have to say and give a really big shout out to the head of the firm that I was at. It was a small firm of 3-4 lawyers.
Okay.
And the head of that firm, I took him out for lunch when I told him I was going to do this and I was going to leave officially.
Yeah.
And he looked at me and he was like, oh, is everything okay? I told him and he was like, first of all, I was worried you were going to say something was wrong. I was like, oh, and I was kind of elated that he was so cool about it.
Yeah, but
he said, look, you have to do this. Go do this. And you'll like, if you don't do this, you're going to regret it. And he said, I'm going to keep you a spot here for, you know, for a few months. You let me know. And
he's
like second father to me. His name is Antonio Azevedo. He's a great guy. And that, I think, helped me as well. I had that community support. Mm-hmm. He's Portuguese Canadian as well. So he he understood about like the struggle and where what I was doing and how unorthodox it was. Yeah. So he really had my back and that helped. But it was scary, Jay. I mean, you're on a mattress. You are getting paid. You're trying to conserve money. You're not making anything. I can't pay off any of my student loan debt.
Right.
I'm in a country. At that time, I hadn't even worked out my immigration status. You know what I mean? Like it was a lot
of like different things like hovering over your head almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
I forgot almost for a second that you were at a smaller law firm and I was going to ask what it was like to leave a company that, you know, you kind of had some, it was probably a little bit comfortable for you, right? You had a solid salary. Like you said, things were going well in that aspect, that kind of financial stability aspect. Would you give any advice to somebody who's like literally thinking that same thing, like how hard it is to actually leave that for something so unstable, which is starting your own business?
Yeah. I mean, my advice would be, you know, you'd be amazed at how having conversations with a lot of people within your organization, whether it's like big or small, a lot of people, I think all of us have dreams to do something. And in some ways people will root for you to get it done. And, you know, I would say first is like, if you can try to build a bit of a safety net, build one. Like sometimes people want the advice to be like, just do it and live without any regrets. But like, that's not as practical. And like, so if you have a steady job, and I think I was also lucky because at the time I was, I didn't have a family in terms of kids and stuff. And I think that obviously complicates things. But I think what my advice would be, even if you will lose that particular job that you have, ask yourself if it would be impossible for you to get a job in a comparable job and whether or not the risk you're about to take might actually improve your kind of resume and your employability or not. Because there's something to be said about the fact that you going away and starting something, a lot of people really respect that. And I think the beautiful thing about the culture and entrepreneurship and even this podcast is, you know, people root for entrepreneurs for the most part. And so what I would say is it's scary. Certainly is, but it's once you jump into it, I didn't regret it. And I think you owe it to yourself. If you truly have the conviction in it, I would encourage you to make the jump.
Right. No, that's great advice. And you also mentioned too, that you were not hesitant, but you felt that your partner kind of had more of the substantive background to start the company. Was that something that you dealt with in your head? Like, you obviously have the mindset and you have the clear aura of like a CEO and a founder, but did you have a little bit of imposter syndrome? Like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, I don't actually, you know, feel like I've got like the bare bones data behind it.
You know, with I don't want to sound overly confident, but yeah, I think
go ahead.
but I think in some ways, me not knowing anything led me to not as much think about that in a weird way. Right. Like right. I would go into meetings with him, and we would talk to people, and then I would say things to people like, "Oh, I disagree," or whatever.
Yeah.
And we would leave, and my co-founder would say, "Hey, you know who that was?" And I'd be like, "No." And then he would be like, "That's so and so, like they're really famous, you know?" Yeah. And I'd be like, yeah. "And I'd be like, oh, shit. Yeah, exactly." And I'd be like, "Did I say anything rude or mean and yeah. or like stupid?" Yeah, and it'd exactly. be like, "No," but like, because I would disagree with people, right? Uh-huh. So I think I think everyone suffers from imposter syndrome. I think the big imposter syndrome I always dealt with more in the startup world was just the mere act of starting a new thing. A lot of the time, you get your community, especially if you're like in my situation, I grew up in a very working class community. I grew up in a place where not too many people graduate college, you know, and the fact that I was moving to California and starting a company for them, that means I'm Mark Zuckerberg already. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was like, that's where I dealt with the imposter syndrome, where it was like, oh my God, you're doing it. This is so amazing. We're so proud of you. And in many ways I was like, let me earn that from you more by having a big business success or having a big impact with access to justice with my first company, et cetera. So I wouldn't say it was on the first part as much as it was when you defy the odds early on, sometimes you get a lot of people who support you, which is very important. And that's where I always felt a little bit of the imposter syndrome was more like, I want to be the person that my community, celebrates me to be as much as possible.
Okay. Yeah. So you're kind of saying that like the almost the naivete of it all kind of helps you in the end because you're able to go into things without knowing how bad you could be going on.
Yeah. And I would say, to be honest, a lot of the time, if you know how hard it all is, sometimes you won't do it. And that's why I always tell people my number one tip of starting up is just do it. It's almost like getting in a pool. I actually think this is a legit analogy here.
Yeah.
Every time you people are in the pool, right? And they're saying, jump in, it's fine, right? Don't they always say, once you get in, it's totally fine, right? They always say that. And you put in your toe, and what do you think? It's freezing. But then you jump, and you look at everyone, and you always say, you're right. Once you get in, it's not so bad. And then you say, actually, it's quite nice. I would say that's entrepreneurship.
yeah. That's a great analogy. I'm going to project here a little bit, but Marcus and I, my co-founder, we always talk about how, like, if we actually knew everything that it would take to start a blog, which is something a lot simpler to do than a full-blown Fortune 500 company, we probably wouldn't have done it. Like, we were just like, we thought it was like, oh, this is going to be so simple. Yes. All this, like, we're going to be able to do it. It's not going to be that hard. It's going to be a simple way to maybe build another stream of income. We had no idea what was all going to happen and how difficult it was actually going to be. Do you kind of look at what you did in the similar light?
1,000%. Like, I remember thinking to myself, well, here's what it was as simple as this. I was like, we identified a problem. We talked to a bunch of people and they all had the problem. I had the problem too.
Yeah.
Doing a bunch of research took too long. The tools that were being used were really old school. There was new technology available because of machine learning and natural language processing, which made it better. My co-founder knew a lot about that space in terms of the technical side of the ball. I knew about the business side of the ball. So I was like, to be honest with you, I was like, okay, we moved down Silicon Valley. A year later, we'll have like, you know, a huge success. And like 2 years from now, we'll have a huge company. I mean, like, I just don't.
Because
I was naive. Because I was like, why wouldn't that happen? Like,
of course.
Right. Of course. Like, and so I do think in many ways, if you know about it all, and if you almost think about it too much, it'll scare you. And it is scary. But I think you know this just with your example. Like, it's once you jump in and it's a lot of work, but it's just one foot in front of the other. And it's like, you don't have to do all 15, 16, 20 steps at once. You do one step at a time and it's really worth it. It's very rewarding.
Yeah. And it's almost like when you do it, then you kind of got it at that point. Like, it's like, you've done it once and you're like, okay, we did this and we figured it out. Then you kind of feel like you can do anything else and you can just figure it out almost on the fly, not on the fly, but like, you kind of, with time, you'll adjust, right?
There's a lot of introspection and there's a lot of getting to know yourself in this game. Like, when you're an entrepreneur, because sometimes if you're at work and doing the classic 9-to-5, which I did for many years, you can kind of clock out mentally sometimes, right? You plug and play. You obviously care. I'm not saying you don't care, but there's an element when you're an entrepreneur, it's like, it's kind of like heightened adrenaline at all times because you're like always kind of trying to figure it out. Even when, you know, you're drinking water, you're walking down the street, you're at the grocery store, your brain's always kind of like, well, how about if we tried this? Or how about if we, and to be honest, like it is overwhelming, but it's very rewarding and it's been a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you spent like 6 years at Ross, right? It was like almost 7 years.
Yeah. Six, seven years. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that's a long time. And then you kind of switch from that to the advisory side almost. Is that kind of how you spent some years?
So, so we're the big thing there is we've been fighting for open access to case law and legal data. Okay. So that fight continues on. And I think I'm feeling really good about it. And after that, what ended up happening was I had to make a decision, which was kind of funny, where I was like, do I go and work? Cause I had a bunch of different job offers. Cause people were like, hey, founder, you know, like with different iterations, I've kind of managed a lot of people. I've made a lot of mistakes in my management. I wasn't a great manager early on. It's a work in progress, but like I kind of went through those 6 years through a lot of flames and iron to kind of make me really employable. In different worlds. And then I was like, I just can't do it. So I ended up starting another one. Cause I was like, I'm addicted to it.
Of course. Yeah. It must've been a little bit of a back and forth though. Like I'm sure the salary offers had to be pretty good. Like Ross was successful, right?
Yeah. It was the same thing again, though. It was the element where I told myself, like I could have done it again. And in many ways I would have made much more money than I was doing at the time. But I was like, you bet on yourself before and it worked out really, really well. And I was like, do you have it in you to bet on you again? And I was like, yes. And this one was a lot easier mentally though, because I ended up founding this company. It's called Automate Medical. I founded it with my employee number one from Ross, who worked very closely with me and a good friend of mine. Who's our CTO, who I've known for like over probably a decade. We've been pals since college. And so there was an element where I had this idea around, this is very easy. And Jay, I think it's kind of, most people will find this pretty fascinating. I think like if you ever get hurt and you go to the hospital and then you need to get your medical records for insurance reasons or anything, it's almost impossible. Like getting your own health data, it's like crazy, right? And what we dream of at Automate Medical is making it easy to have your health data be easily synced so that you get it on your phone. You can do a whole bunch of things with it. And it's not just for you, but it's for everyone. Like once a patient goes to multiple hospitals, a lot of those doctors don't know what happened before, et cetera. So we think that everyone's health outcomes would be easier if all the data was synced, shareable, and then you could do like Moneyball for medicine where, you know, they can start to actually look at people and say, Jay might be really good with, you know, this surgery for this reason, Andrew's shorter or taller or bigger or whatever, and this is better for him. And there just isn't enough like data science in health. And a lot of that is because the data for the data science is missing. So we kind of want to put the data into the data science. So it was another big field, like going from law into health, like, you know, it's kind of another old school industry. So there was an element where that was familiar. And I really like working on things. And I think this comes from my inspiration when we were talking about why I wanted to be an entrepreneur to begin with, is making, having a dent, a positive effect in the world. Right. And so I like to find things that are good for, as a business, you can make money, you can make people invest in you money, because that's important. Like, but at the same time, in doing so, you know, it makes the world a little bit of a better place. And there's a cliche in the TV show Silicon Valley where basically everyone pitches their company. And then at the end of it, they say to make the world a better place, like, you know, a better dog walking out and make the world a better place.
You know, for you mean it.
Well, the good news is the track record is like, I went to law first and focused on access to justice. And now I'm focusing on improving health outcomes. So hopefully the work of my team with Automate and the team at Ross speaks for itself. So
100%. Like, I think like when you look at what you did with Ross, like obviously you were helping, I feel like you were helping a more specific like target of people. I could be wrong about that, but I feel like with this, with Automate, it's like you're helping like anybody, like anybody could benefit from that. Like most people could, right? Like,
Well, the problem with Ross was I really wanted to make the law more accessible for everyone. And I think what you just said is extremely telling. Like we think of the law as this faraway thing. And there was an element in me that wanted everyone to be able to have affordable legal service that was computable as well.
Yeah.
And so, and that's why we're still kind of ongoing with what's going on there. But I think with Automate, you're absolutely right. I think the idea, especially this past year with this pandemic, just showed how important it is to have a really good health system. Right. And I think right now, the fact is, if you go to hospitals, doctors, nurses, and everyone who's health professionals, everyone, right down to the janitorial staff, are just some of the most dedicated people in the world. And they just don't have the best technology. And while it's not as sexy to build in these spaces that I've chosen to build in, I think because of that, like everyone, it actually applies to everyone. It has been really neat.
Right. Yeah. And you said like, so for you, when you look at it, you think that, you know, obviously you want that side of it, the law, to be more accessible to everyone, but you also kind of look at Automate and you're like, even though they're both beneficial, the health side of it is a little bit more like overtly and like obviously beneficial to people. But for like most normal people don't really look at the law as something they need to pay attention to, even though they probably should, right?
Exactly. And they probably should. Yeah. So the goal there was really just to make sure it, my dream still is that like we look at the law and, you know, if you need to sign a new employment contract or something, that you could go to a place that's like, you know, in a strip mall, that on and for $40, maybe even like upload it to a piece of software first and then get a readout that says, hey, watch out for this, this or that. I think we go through life without interacting with the law enough because it's so expensive.
So
we don't think of it. Whereas we're kind of forced to deal with it, even though sometimes health can be just as expensive.
Yeah.
If you break your ankle or if you get an illness, you have no choice. Whereas I think sometimes with legal stuff, people almost just ignore it because it's not a physical, a thing that brings them down physically.
Right, right. It's not something they have to really seek out unless it's super, super important. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Even though they might be living in less than ideal situations, you know what I'm saying?
So, yeah. Yeah.
It's been that has been good. And I think for me to almost like join a bunch of different parts of my life is that, you know, when my family first got to Canada, my grandma on my dad's side worked as a cleaning lady in a hospital. And my grandmother on my mom's side was a cleaning lady for, you know, in law offices in the big skyscraper. Mm. So there's an element that has been this kind of drive forward in going in just one generation and trying to make an impact those industries and kind of continuing their legacy. So I think about my grandparents a lot and their sacrifices, which has been a big thing. So, you know, when you say even the other questions like, what motivates me and kind of making the jump, et cetera. I think a lot of that is motivated by my desire to make their sacrifices worth it.
Right. Right. So they probably look now and they always respected it, but I feel like it's been quite some time now. Do they look at it now and they're kind of like, okay, you were right. Like,
yeah. So my mom and dad, I ended up losing both sides of the grandparents. Rest in peace to them. But yeah, my parents and everyone is extremely nice. And I think they're all very, very, very proud, which is a great feeling. And and I think that's where there's still a little bit of the imposter syndrome with the community that I grew up in. Cause when I walk around, people are very complimentive and like very, very nice to me. And I still want to be the person who they exalt me to be. So it's very motivational for me. So that I'm like, hey, you know what? This one, I want to be able to have even more of an impact. I want to keep going,
Yeah. So that you come back home and kind of the people around you are like, they're looking at you like you did. You're like Jeff Bezos almost. I was like, that's, there's no, like, they don't see the in between almost.
No, Bezos. Yeah. They don't see an in between at all. Yeah. Actually. Yeah. Yeah. And that's really, it's really, really sweet. And, the other thing though, which is really nice is when I would come home, people would just ask me how I was doing and they really just had my back, in like a very fundamental way, which is always really nice. Like in many ways, what I realized is, they didn't really care at all. And they were celebrating me taking the risk and trying. Mm-hmm. And so that goes back to that whole thing about advice for anyone listening. I think while it's scary and you think sometimes, oh, what if I screw up? People are going to laugh at me or people might, you know, think less of me. Yeah. Most people that I've ever run into, even people that I don't think really liked me from before, you know, whatever, everyone is just like, hey, you know what, whatever you say about that guy, he tried.
Yeah.
And he continues to every day.
Exactly. That's honestly interesting you mentioned that, because something I'm curious about is when you were home and the people you were surrounded with, was that something that you thought about a lot? Like, did you see the people, or not see, but did you like kind of feel the people around you and feel like you needed something different and you need something more out of yourself, like to surround yourself with more people kind of on a similar mission to be able to get to where you were trying to be?
I thought that, I mean, I actually have this really interesting, fun thing where I think some of the wisest, sharpest, and most amazing people are from my community, or people who might not have graduated high school. Right. But I do think like part of the move to Silicon Valley was simply, and it's as simple as, you know, if you want to be an actor, you're probably going to want to go to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And if you want to be in tech, I think like finding a tech centered city, you know, there's a few, but you know, you could go to New York, Boston, there's a whole bunch of new crops like Austin and everywhere. So I'm not saying Silicon Valley is the only play, but I also think also for someone who didn't know much, it's kind of like you want to be an actor, you go to Hollywood, you want to be in tech, you go to Silicon Valley. It's almost if anything, it's a little bit more naive too. But and now I don't like, you know, I don't think that's the case. Toronto, for example, has an amazing tech community. I think that also was that naivete. Like,
of course. You're like, this is where I need to be if this is going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
No ifs, ands, or buts.
You don't know anything. You don't know anything. You're just like, that's where it is. You know, like, I want to be in show business. I flew to LA. And you want to be a country music star.
Dropped everything and moved over to LA.
And why do we do it? Because that's what the story we're told. And like, the thing is, like, I actually think there are many, many ways to do it without doing what I did. And I don't think that everyone and my reality and what worked for me will work for everyone. And I encourage everyone to find what works for you. But sometimes there is something to be said about just like, there's these easy things to do, that kind of help without you thinking about it. So by me, you know, we applied for Y Combinator, got that funding and moved down. And then that was helpful because, you know, when you go out for lunch, people who are sitting next to you are talking about a bunch of things that are relevant to you. And, you know, you start swapping notes with people. So it is nice to be in an environment where everyone gets it. But just as much, every time I went back to my neighborhood and talked to family and friends and hung out with people, that was always like me recharging my batteries, because it gave me what real life was too. Because whenever you get super deep into a rabbit hole of anything, like whether you're playing basketball or hockey, or whether you're an artist, whether you're whatever, architect, I think like you need to not just immerse yourself completely with people who are in that world, or else you lose sight of things. And I think you're better at solving problems in your world by understanding all the worlds around you.
Yeah.
Everything touches, you know?
Mm. Yeah. You have different experiences. They kind of allow you to, you know, have different perspectives when you're in a different type of community. And for you, like, you were a TEDx speaker as well, right? You are a TEDx speaker.
I did a TED talk on artificial intelligence and increasing access to justice.
Right. And that also, you know, your perspectives have to obviously help kind of resonate with the audience there a little bit, right? Because you came from literally first generation immigrant to where you are now. So you're kind of able to project a little bit with everybody else who you were you're talking to almost, right?
Exactly. And I think one of the things about Silicon Valley, for example, and other tech communities, is sometimes it's like there's this idea of like, who's the consumer and this mystical person who purchases technology.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's my cousins, it's my uncle, it's my aunt, it's my parent. Like, you know, like, and so for me, a lot of the things weren't theory as much as they were reality. And I got to straddle both worlds. And I think it made me better at both in many ways, where I was able to actually know and not lose sight of what's real in life.
Yeah. Yeah. It has to all help. And you probably look back now at your entire journey, just from where you began to where you are now. And how exactly do you look at it? And like, what would you say to somebody who is also kind of in that spot for that you were in, or maybe something a little bit similar. Like they have that itch that you had, that was, you always wanted to start something in some way that was a little bit unorthodox, but you might be a little hesitant, or there are social pressures like family. Like, what would you say to like that person listening?
Yeah, I would really tell them that, first of all, I would tell you that you can do it and that you're not crazy to believe in yourself, that you have the ability to make the change and do whatever you want to do, regardless if it's in technology or if it's pursuing, you know, if you want to be a stand-up comedian or be an actor, or yeah. Go back to school and get a degree in another thing that you want to do, whatever you want to do, a career change. I think you can do it. And in many ways, what I would tell them is you're worth it, you know, and life is very, very short. And I think a lot of the things that hold us back are a fear that of ourselves and our own ability, but there's also an element of like, what will other people think if I don't, if it doesn't work out, or what will other people think if it's not successful or whatever. And what I would tell you is most people are so busy thinking about themselves that they won't even think about it at all. Or if they do, it's usually really positive. A lot of people, I think, will give you credit for trying. And when we're all little kids, we try a lot more. And then when we get older, I think we start getting embarrassed because there are people who, you know, get first prize at the science fair and then their second prize and third prize. But that's at that moment in life. That's when you're like 13 or 14, for example, right?
Yeah.
But what's to say if you don't keep plugging away, the person who came sixth isn't going to actually be the best overall in their career.
Right.
And so what I would tell everyone listening, it's like, you know, the game is very long in terms of what you're up to in life. And it's never too late to do what you want to do and try. And you don't even have to do it fully off the jump. I'm not a crazy person. Sometimes I think people who come from better kind of socioeconomic means are like, leave your job, do everything. Like, that's very difficult. So what I would say, you don't have to necessarily do it right off the jump where you make the full jump. You know, you can start an online small business. You can start having conversations with startups, doing something that you have an idea in, maybe get your feet wet that way. So don't think of everything as an all or nothing proposition.
Like,
I have an idea for a new thing, and that means I have to do all these things. No, think about other things you can do and kind of transition. Because here's the thing. You might not even like it if you try it, but then there might be another idea you want to pursue. So it's not all or nothing.
Yeah. And it's also like, you mentioned it a little bit, but it's, you don't realize how many people are probably supporting you, because the people who aren't supporting you, it feels so much louder in your head almost, right?
Yeah. And it's all in your head. I would say a lot of it is in your head. Like, I think we all are in this Instagram, Facebook, hustle culture where we think everyone is eating shrimp and lobster every day, and everyone is on a private jet, and everyone just released a hit record, and everyone is like the best thing since sliced bread, and we're all on vacation apparently too, like all of us, right? Like, everyone is on vacation, right? It's like, no. So we have been viewing things through a distorted lens. And, you know, I actually ended up deleting Facebook and Instagram. And, I'm not going to tell you to do that either, and like just kind of sweeping generalizations. But there's an element where like the real world is literally you, your friends, the people in your environment, and not necessarily the internet and outside perceptions of you. And if you're scared to do something you want to do because of outside perceptions, a lot of the time that's really just made up in your head.
Yeah. No, Andrew, man, like, I think that was like super, super insightful and helpful. And from your perspective, it's got to be so, so relatable for a lot of people, because I think it's always a lot better, not better, but it's always a lot more interesting for somebody, the average person, to hear a story from your perspective of somebody who started very relatable beginnings from most people who are probably listening to this. So I appreciate you being so open about it, and, you know, really looking forward to seeing all the other great things Automate's going to continue to do.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think, first of all, it's an honor to be invited on. It's an honor to share my story. I think as human beings, we used to sit around fires and share stories with each other. And I think that, you know, podcasts have become almost kind of like the new, like, fire, chat side.
Really,
you know, for anyone listening to this, I believe in you. And I think that you can do a lot more than even you think you can do. And it's not a slogan and a cliche. and I'm not like turning my chair around and sitting like a cool teacher in school to try to tell you what you can do it. But, you know, there's an element where I think the imagination and our dreaming muscle starts to wane when you get older, especially when you get a job and reality starts hitting, because reality is real, you know. Yeah. You got to pay the bills, you got to do this, you got to do that. But don't lose sight and don't lose perspective. And it's not all or nothing. Yeah. It's not, oh, if I really want to pursue my dream of, you know, designing dresses, then that means I have to leave my current job and risk it all. No, right. You can start sketching. You might be able to take a few courses online. You might want to be able to ask some people. So I don't know, Jay, I think the other piece of advice that I would say, because, you know, now that we're just kind of like reaching the end of the conversation, yeah. that I think is something I haven't touched on, is for everyone listening, don't ever underestimate the power of reaching out and asking a question to someone you admire,
yeah.
someone in the industry. A lot of people are, I realize, are just like me, and are just like everyone else who really tried and really wanted it. And everyone usually gets a mentor or two. And that's where I would also spend some time, like, you know, send some messages and ask people. It's not, you're not asking anything from them other than, hey, can you hop on a call and just let me know how you did this? And that's why I love this podcast, because yeah. you share those stories. So this is good way to do it. But like, if someone's a guest, like, I'm happy to chat with anyone that listens to this. Reach out to me on Twitter. My DMs are open at Andrew Ruta. But it's not just me. It's basically everyone. People I've looked up to that were like these people on these exalted mountaintops, I would send them messages early days and say, hey, I'm really struggling with this. Could you help me? And like, the next week they were on a Zoom call with me or on a phone call or having a coffee. So a lot of people don't ask. So don't be afraid to ask.
Yeah. And for anywhere you could find Automate Medical, you know, any place that everybody could find you, you know, obviously feel free to drop that here. So everybody knows where to go. Yeah.
So to find out what we're up to, our main website is automatemedical.com. I have a fun blog that I run where I drop pieces about that. But if you head to my Twitter, that's usually a good spot. I'm usually making a bunch of really, really, really bad dad jokes. So if you want to groan, and if you really want to see things that like, I hope I get an eye roll. That's where you'll find me.
Yeah. That's how you don't get affected. Enjoy that. Well, all right, man, we're really excited about that. Really excited to check out the dad jokes and obviously all the great things that you guys are going to continue to do and, you know, changing the medical space. So I appreciate you coming on, man, and can't wait to keep in touch.
Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it.
And that'll do it, everyone. That was Andrew Ruta, founder and CEO of Automate Medical. Incredibly intelligent guy, just shines through. As a first generation immigrant, it's really awesome that he was able to overcome those social pressures that, you know, come along with being a first generation immigrant. He's done it and he's done it successfully, so it should inspire anybody from any position to be able to do the same. But, you know, until next time, we'll be back next Friday. Another interview with a young, successful, relatable entrepreneur. You're not going to want to miss it. Peace out, y'all.